Service is lousy as well. So poor us. It's scary. It is scary, this loss of privilege. It's kind of humiliating. You want to lash out, and you might want to vote for someone like Donald Trump or Pauline Hanson. Or perhaps you take it in your stride and you realise that there's no way to morally justify unequal access to privilege. You understand that there's no reasonable argument for why women should not have equal rights and status in society, or to deny our Indigenous peoples rights to their ancestral lands, or to fail to do what we can for those who are suffering from natural or political disasters internationally. And you might even decide to embrace the planet's extraordinary diversity, which enriches us all. There's 7.5 billion people on the planet right at this moment, almost exactly. So we're in a bit of a crunch time, brought on by population pressure, overconsumption, waste, and immense inequality. In the face of this crunch, we can retreat into nationalism, factionalism, and racism, and spend the next decades and centuries in a spiral of increasing violence and environmental degradation. Or we can try to deal with this with our many shared problems in a spirit of inclusiveness and common humanity, use our brains, apply basic principles of justice. Certain people, including a bunch of white middle-aged males clinging desperately to privilege and power, seem to favour that first option of retreat into factionalism. In a roundabout way, this brings me to my two novels. I've been thinking lately about why I want to write at all. Fundamentally, it's an innate need to express myself in the best way I know how. The need to communicate is what makes us human, or largely what makes us human. And we all have this need to communicate. We all find our own ways of doing it. And it serves many purposes, but one of the most important is self-understanding. We see vague, blurry pictures of ourselves in the responses of others to our attempts at communication. And we're forever sending out these little sonar pings and interpreting the blips on the screen, trying to get a clearer picture of ourselves, of our place in the world, and ultimately what we're doing here. For me, my sonar pings partly take the form of written words. I've always liked writing, always wanted to write, pretty much since I could hold a pencil. And I've always wanted to write novels. But it took me until my early to mid 40s to start. And lately I've been wondering why it took me so long. And I think the answer is that for a long time I had nothing to say. I had a need to say something to ping out, but I didn't know what it was. And two factors came together that impelled me to finally attempt a novel. The first was the realisation that I'm not immortal. I've been busy enjoying life, working, raising a family, collecting experiences. And novel writing was something to be done later, you know, in that orgastic future that we all like to think still lies ahead. In my 40s, I realised I'd better start, or it might suddenly be too late. And the second factor was what I still think was a shocking change in our country. And finally, I had something I needed to write about. Before I go into that, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about my... After I was born in Lee Creek. On my father's side of the family, we've been here almost from the beginning of white settlement, so I feel very South Australian. Dad, who died last year, loved this place so much that he requested that we sing Bound for South Australia at his funeral, which was a really eccentric choice in fitting, in keeping with him. But we raised the rafters with it, and it was really very moving, and it made me realise how much he really did love South Australia. Both my novels are set in this state, and Ecstasy Lake is deliberately partly a portrait of Adelaide. But I didn't always love it here. When I was 19, I couldn't leave fast enough. Adelaide and South Australia seemed staid, boring, and frankly a little bit dead. So I left when I was 19, and I didn't come back except for holidays, for nearly 25 years. I went to Canberra and studied forestry at ANU in the early to mid 1980s. I worked on mine sites in Western Australia, including a modern day gold mine, which the experience of that helped me writing Ecstasy Lake. I worked in forests, strangely enough, as a forester. I worked as a volunteer assistant for scientists, including a 3-month stint in the Yukon in winter, which was pretty amazing, and 2 or 3 amazing weeks on a deserted desert island off the coast of Western Australia, just teeming with wildlife. Eventually I found a niche as a writer and editor, and since the early 1990s I've mostly been writing and editing about international forestry, things like biodiversity, climate change, and Indigenous people's rights, and sustainable forest management. For many years I edited the newsletter on sustainable forest management in the tropics. It was a role that took me all over the world, to some fascinating places, from Borneo to remote villages in the Amazon to West Africa, and I also lived in Japan for about 8 years working for an international forestry organisation. So it took quite a long time before I fell back in love with South Australia and before I was able to come home. I'm here for good now. I live in the hills, which I love, and every day I think how lucky, how privileged I am to live in this part of the world, in a peaceful country, in a place where the principles of good governance still prevail. Or at least they did. But something fairly shocking happened has happened here in recent years, I think. I'm not a historian, probably some of you are, but to me there was a fundamental change in Australia in 2001. It had been coming from well before then, but 2001 was an identifiable turning point. First there was the Tampa incident, in which a boatload of asylum seekers was denied permission to land on Australian soil. There was the Children Overboard incident, when a boatload of asylum seekers was accused of throwing children into the water so the Navy would pick them up, an accusation that later turned out to be false. There'd been riots in the mainland asylum seeker detention centres, including at our own Woomera Detention Centre, which just happened to be located in that mysterious territory called the Woomera Prohibited Area. And following quickly on all this was 9/11 and the extraordinary fear of terrorism that pervaded the Western world in its aftermath. Even from Australia, even from Japan, where I was living at the time, it was clear to me that people in Australia were conflating their fear of asylum seekers and their fear of terrorism, and were worried that terrorists were entering Australia pretending to be refugees. Then came the Bali bombing, heightening the fear. We went to war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and Australia changed in some fairly fundamental ways, I think. I think we'd become a harder, less tolerant, and less attractive country in the process. But all's not lost. I mean, we still live in the best place in the world. I believe Australians are mostly incredibly decent, humane, and generous. And so I have faith in us, but it does distress me that somehow we've allowed ourselves to be hoodwinked by lies and posturing by our politicians. And writing a novel was the best way I could think of to express both my distress and my faith in us as a country. And this brings me to Prohibited Zone, my first novel, which is set in the aftermath of 9/11, and it starts with a breakout from the Woomera Detention Centre. I won't go into the plot now, rather I'd like to tell you a little bit of the backstory of one of the characters, a young Afghani woman called Syra, who has escaped the detention centre, aided by a combative protester called Kara and a guy called Steve Westy, who happens to be passing by at the time and is roped in by Kara. Westy is the novel's narrator and protagonist. To quote a reviewer of Prohibited Zone, Westy is one of those hard men with soft democratic centres. He's a bit of a knockabout bloke, a mining engineer who's never really cared too much about anything, really. Not about women and certainly not about causes. But he meets a woman with a cause, Kara, And he kind of falls for her as he helps her out. And although he doesn't like to get involved in things, when push comes to shove, he does care about justice. Syra is the focus of a manhunt involving police, ASIO, the CIA, and a bunch of vigilantes out for a reward. She's of particular interest because of her friendship with another woman escapee, Amir, who is a suspected terrorist and who's disappeared. Not even Syra knows where he is. So this talk is about to get a little bit heavy, if it hasn't already been a bit heavy. So before I plunge into that, I'd like to point out that actually there's a great deal of humour in my novels. I was going to say that after I told you Syra's backstory, but probably not. A reader recently commented on my Facebook page that the Aussie humour in Prohibited Zone had her in stitches. She said she couldn't remember previously laughing out loud when reading a book. The sense of humour is a prerequisite in the Saar family. Dad loved telling funny stories, and he could always make us laugh. Even in his final days in palliative care, he didn't lose his ability to poke gentle fun. Humour for him, I think, was a way of diminishing terror. If you could laugh at something, you can diminish that terror. At one point in his last days, we were giving him something called thickened water, which I'd never heard of before, but it helps you drink when you're having trouble swallowing. And we labelled a plastic cup, thickened. And when we gave it to Dad, he read the word out loud as thick head. And he said, "Oh, right," as if to say, "So that's what you think of me." It was quintessential Dad. It was funny in its context. It was actually quite beautiful, and it gave us a bright moment in what was a pretty dark time. But I'd like to read a short passage now from Prohibited Zone to give you a taste of the novel's admittedly fairly earthy humour. Westy has enlisted the help of a tracky mate of his called Cole to help smuggle Syra to Adelaide from somewhere south of Woomera. So they're out on the Stuart Highway. Westy and Kara emerge from a hiding place after a night sleeping rough. And although I'm still reading from my script, this is actually taken from the book. I grabbed my swag and carried it to the highway, parked 50 metres or so to the south on a wide shoulder of the road was Cole's road train, its hazards flashing and engine idling. Cole was standing by its side, taking a piss with his back to us. We walked towards him. "Do you know him?" asked Kara. "Yep." "And the point is, he's going to take Syra to Adelaide." "Why?" "Because there's a police roadblock this side of Port Augusta, and she'll be caught if she stays with us." Cole finished his slash with a shake, a dip, and a fart, and turned our way. He was taken aback to see us. "Jesus, I wasn't expecting an audience." "We weren't expecting a performance," he said. I felt a bit uncomfortable reading that to such an august audience. But I have to say, the image that conjures up in my mind still makes me smile. And even though my wife told me I shouldn't laugh at my own jokes. So let me tell you a little bit about Syra. She's from the Hazara ethnic group, and she was born in Kabul in the Soviet era in Afghanistan. The Russians took away her mother and sister as sex slaves and later killed them. And some nasty thing that her two brothers also met nasty fates, which I won't go into now. Syra's beauty has attracted the attention of a Taliban mullah who one day comes to the house. Her father is a broken man now, but in a final act of defiance, he objects to the mullah taking away his last remaining child. So the mullah shoots him dead. The mullah attempts to rape Syra, but Amir rescues her and the two flee Afghanistan. They spend a few months in a refugee camp in Pakistan, and from there they make it to Indonesia, and then by overcrowded boat to Australia. "Why Australia?" someone asks. "My father liked Australia," Cyrus says. "He said it was a good place, and that we would be treated with respect." But her father had been misinformed. Syra and Amir are treated like criminals, placed in a detention centre in a remote and forbidding part of the country, away from scrutiny, away from proper oversight. And if history tells us anything, it's that without proper oversight, people in positions of authority abuse their power. among other horrific abuse, Syra is raped by a guard. With Kara's help, she wants to tell her story to the world in the hope that the world will listen and then act to ensure justice for asylum seekers, to which they're entitled under international law and any standard of human decency. Syra's story is made up, but everything that happens to her in fiction has happened to many, many asylum seekers in real life, including rapes by detention centre guards. And it's impossible to hear those sorts of stories and not be affected. I'm not a human rights campaigner or any kind of activist, but a mark of society, of civilised society, is surely its capacity to offer sanctuary to oppressed peoples. So when I saw signs that our society was losing this mark, the urge to write, to tell such stories, was strong enough for me to start and eventually finish Prohibited Zone. I didn't want to write a preachy book, unlike probably been preaching to you tonight. I wanted the characters to tell their own stories, and I wanted to write a thriller that would entertain readers. And many people have told me they couldn't put the book down, and I really love hearing that because it tells me they cared about the characters, that they bought into the story, and that they were entertained. And that's definitely what it's intended to be, entertainment. But the energy to write it came initially from that sense of injustice that I felt. So the considerable amount of mostly positive feedback I received on Prohibited Zone was it was encouraging. People seemed to like Westy, and I wanted him to feature in my second novel. Westy is one of my ilk. You know, he's white, male, he's a bit younger than me. He represents, in my mind, the best of the Aussie male. He has a good sense of humour, he's irreverent, he's casual, he's fair-minded. Gross. He treats people on their merits. And perhaps most importantly, he holds the line on our behalf, what might be called the decency line that I hope most of us feel shouldn't be crossed in a civilised society. Ecstasy Lake, my second novel, is not as overtly political as Prohibited Zone. In writing it, I started with a character, Tasso, who's based loosely on a friend of mine. He's actually not even Australian, but he's an entertaining character. Tasso is a Australian, but the guy he's based on is not. The plot revolves around the discovery and secret location of a gold ore deposit somewhere in desert South Australia, somewhere out near Lee Creek. The man who discovered it, Nick Hiskey, has been brutally murdered, and Westy and his friend Tasso are the only two people who know the location of the ore body. Tasso is loud, brilliant, and filthy rich. Actually, unlike my friend. I like him as I like my friend, but he has a few flaws. And one of these is a blind spot when it comes to his attitude to women. Again, I won't tell you more about the plot of Ecstasy Lake, but I would like to tell you a bit about Fern, who in the novel is Tasso's girlfriend. She's a strong, spirited woman who nonetheless has pretty much been in Tasso's gravitational pull for more than a decade. She once tried to escape by going to America to study, but Tasso found her and convinced her to come back to Australia. She wants children, but Tasso's not interested. She knows he plays around with other women, but mostly she swallows this. So she's compromised. She's an intelligent woman who's succumbed to the attraction of money. She's certainly not the only person to do that in the novel. And also, I think, to love. And she's discovered that compromising herself in this way has made her profoundly unhappy. I've observed similar relationships in real life in which the man has power over the woman with his wealth and strength of character, the strength of personality. In Ecstasy Lake, the power imbalance ultimately produces a huge emotional detonation with some fairly grim consequences. The power struggles are going on all around us all the time and amongst us. I find them interesting, and of course they're important ingredients in most, if not all, thrillers, and probably most novels. There's another strong female character in Ecstasy Lake. Her name's Melody, and she's the girlfriend of a local bikie called Harlan. She seems to see Westy as a means of escaping from Harlan, who's physically abusive towards her. So I'd like to read you a scene now from Ecstasy Lake. It's mostly dialogue, so I hope you can tell who's saying what. Probably doesn't really matter. It takes place fairly early on in the novel, as Melody and Westy start getting to know each other. They're in a Mexican restaurant just south of the city. You might even have been there. It's one of a chain where you have to raise a little flag to attract the attention of the waiter. So Melody and Steve are eating nachos and drinking margaritas. Melody wiped a crumb from her mouth. "What do you see in Tasso? I know he's rich, but you don't seem the sort of person who likes rich for riches' sake. We've been friends for years." "That doesn't answer the question. I don't think I like him. I'm curious why you do." "Tasso has his flaws, such as the way he views women." The waitress came to take our order. "Two more again, thanks." We looked at each other as the waitress lowered the flag and took our empty glasses. "What do you mean by that?" "We're just vaginas on legs to him." "I wouldn't say that. He likes women."
"Does he?"
"He likes vaginas." "Of course he likes women. He's just not interested in relationships." Which was my point, I think. "I suppose you could call his attitude to women a flaw, perhaps his main flaw, but he has strengths."
"Such as?"
"He's loyal. Tasso always looks out for his friends. He might scold them and yell at them. He might make fun of them. But in the end, he'll always look out for them."
"And that's what you like about him?"
"Yeah, I like that he's loyal to his friends. He's also smart, funny, generous."
"So you're prepared to overlook the way he treats women?"
"I don't overlook it. But the women he takes to bed are over 18.
Just.
Presumably they can make decisions for themselves. He doesn't hit them. He's always charming. He gives them money and jewellery and apartments. As far as I'm concerned, they can decide for themselves if it's worth it."
"Uh-huh. Is that not correct?"
"They might not always have a choice."
"I don't know what you mean."
"Forget it then."
"Okay, I'll forget it. What should we do now?"
"What would you like to do?"
She looked straight into my eyes.
"Drink another couple and then dodge the breathalyzers back to your place."
"Uh-huh.
Have I shocked you?"
"No. What I mean is, yes.
Am I just a dick on legs to you?"
"Of course not."
"You're kind of blunt."
"Life's short. Why waste it being reserved? I like you, you like me. What's to stop us having a fun evening?"
"Harlan?"
"Only if he finds out."
The waitress came with the drinks. I wasn't sure I was in the mood for frozen margaritas anymore. We sat for a while in silence, drinking our drinks and nibbling our food.
"I can't do it," I said.
She looked like she didn't care much.
"Why not?
Is there someone else?" I thought for a moment, wondering how much I should say. "There was someone."
"Was?"
"Was. But I'm not sure I can be with someone else. Not yet. Not someone like you." I couldn't take my eyes off her exquisite lips.
"What do you mean, someone like me?"
"I don't know." I heard the chatter and clatter of the restaurant for the first time in a long time.
"Anyway, it's too risky for you."
"As I say, life's short. Sometimes you've got to take a risk."
"I thought you were a risk taker."
"You're mad at me."
"I don't think I'm mad at you. Maybe we've misunderstood each other."
"Maybe. I want to see you again."
"Why?"
"To clear up the misunderstanding."
"I should go."
The restaurant ordered her a taxi and we waited for it outside under an old plum tree, its fruit already fallen. It was a moonless night, a night without prospect, a night made for empty hearts. There was the smell of rotting fruit. The taxi arrived and hit us with its headlights. She took my hand and led me away a few steps out of the glare. She kissed me on the lips. It only lasted a moment, but it seemed as if the moment froze. She tasted of salt, lime, and alcohol. It was a margarita kiss, a dangerous kiss, an edge of the abyss kiss. It was the kind of kiss that could drive you mad or to do bad things, or maybe good things. It was a hell of a thing to do to a man. She turned and made her way to the taxi. I waved her goodbye. Then I had to sit down for a while among the rotting plums. So my wife said to me, "You're reading two passages from your novels, and all you can talk about are farts, dicks, and vaginas." All I can say is, in my defence, is that some people never grow up. So Ecstasy Lake is about more than power imbalances. One of my aims in writing novels set in South Australia is to develop a sense of place. Among other things, Tasso is ambitious for Adelaide. He says he wants to make it great. When writing the novel, I asked
many people actually, whether they thought Adelaide could be a great city. And there were two basic responses. Some people said, well, it's already a great city. What are you going on about? And other people said, nah, I don't think it could ever be a great city. The novel explores this question a little bit, and I think it comes to a conclusion of sorts. Personally, I think it can be a great city. In his review of Ecstasy Lake, Michael Savas at Flinders University wrote that part of the making of greatness in a place is surely to name it in culture and people's imaginations in the way that Ecstasy Lake does. I think what he means is that reflecting our places back at us through fiction and other forms of art is part of the process of creating a strong sense of place and thereby building greatness. And I agree with that. It's a kind of a riff on the idea of these sonar pings that we send out to create images that help us understand our place. The novel is also about greed, the merits or otherwise of a mining boom, and love. There are liberal doses of guns, drugs, booze, sex, and violence. There's a biker gang war, a clandestine drug lab, a moonlight chase through the mangroves out near Garden Island, a shootout at Truro, and other stuff. Many Adelaideans have said that they love reading a novel set so strongly in their own city. Catherine England, the literary critic at The Advertiser, wrote that it's still an unusual treat for Adelaide readers to be able to map their reading on the familiar grid of their own city. Alistair Sarr's second novel suggests that he could well do for Adelaide what Peter Corris has long done for Sydney in his arresting and memorable style. I took the liberty of reading out that pretty flattering review. Well, that's exactly what I want to do. I want to own this landscape in a literary sense, at least in the thriller genre. So my characters will roam this city, this state. They'll menace it, they'll lord it up, they'll make plans and they'll commit crimes. And some people will try to stop them. And occasionally I hope these idiots will make you laugh. But I think Ecstasy Lake is it's a more mature novel than Prohibited Zone. In writing it, I felt surer of myself as a writer, perhaps more in control of the material. I plan to keep writing and keep improving, and maybe speeding up the process a little bit. I started writing Prohibited Zone in 2006, and it was published in 2011. Ecstasy Lake took another 5 years, and was published last year. And I want to write at least 10 novels in my lifetime, and at the rate of 5 a year, that's 8 more, 40 years I'll be in my mid-90s. So I do need to speed it up if I'm going to achieve my goal. But finding the time and headspace to write is a real challenge. I wrote the first draft of Ecstasy Lake when I was on assignment in Rome for a UN organisation. I was there for 10 months and I didn't have my family with me, so I had my weekends to myself. And I could either write a novel or I could go and explore Italy, and I chose to write a novel. So on weekends I would fortify myself in a cosy little apartment, large quantities of coffee, Italian food, wine and beer, and immerse myself in this in a fictional world, which resembles the one that we all know, but which I hope is infused with the golden light of imagination, if not with alcohol. It is immensely satisfying to populate such a world and grant life to characters. That's another reason for wanting to write. It's incredibly good fun. By my hand, these characters live and die. They talk, they laugh, they squabble, they fight, they make love, and they do other stupid things. And ultimately, most of them find some sort of justice, and that's also satisfying to be able to achieve justice when sometimes you feel powerless to do it in the real world. It's my hope that they entertain you, the readers, as they're doing all that stuff, and that you'll cheer them on. And I hope that in my writing I show that some of my ilk, I would say the large majority of us, are happy to shed our sense of privilege, sit with everyone else at the back of the plane, and to work in an admittedly humble way for a better world. Thank you.